Need to look at two psukim, one and put the bookmark in it. Perek Yud. And pasuk kaf hey, Yud kaf hey. And then the second pasuk that we're going to, it's a brother compliment pasuk, or it's sister compliment pasuk, is in Perek Yud bet. Pasuk lamed bet. So it's page 344 and 358. These psukim are related in theme. I brought one source, there's Naim LaTorah, actually does make the connection between them. That's the only reason why I photocopied the Naim LaTorah of Sarutskin, to show you that it's not me who's making up the connection. Because if you look at both psukim, they have the same underlying message. So take a look one first on Perek Yud. Paro says to Moshe, it's a very beautiful progression of dialogue and negotiation until actually culminates in Vehi Bishal Paro et Am. We know that. We're going to touch upon later, very tangentially, a little bit of the intentionality of Moshe with all of the subterfuge, with the different types of temptations or explanations that are given to Paro, why he should let the Jewish people go and take gold klei chesed klei zav. We'll speak a little bit about that and smalot and the morality of that. We're not going to get too much into it, but we will touch upon it through the Netziv. So if you look at in Pasuk, I guess you start from Kav Dalet, Vayikra Faro El Moshe, Vayomer Lechu Ivdu Et Adonai, Rak Tzonchem Uvekarchem Yutzag, only your Tzonchem and your cattle will all stay behind. Gam Tabchem Yalechimachem. I think the simple explanation is that economically, if they were to leave behind their cattle, Paro thought it would be a hook to have them return. Moshe Rabbeinu's response: Vayomer Moshe, Gam Ata Titein Biyadeinu Zvachim Bolot, Vasinu Adonai Eloheinu, VeGam Miknenu Yelech. And also, our cattle is going to go. So Moshe emphatically, with a very strong, resolute negotiation tactic, said, "Not only are we going to take our cattle," when Moshe said that, when Paro said, "You won't be taking your cattle. You're going to give us. Not that we're going to take your cattle. You're going to give us to go with you to us when we leave. You're going to give us your cattle." And Moshe Rabbeinu says, and here's the point that the Ramban picks up on: "Gam ata titein biyadeinu zvachim va'olot." You're going to give us cattle not just so we can have it for economic gain. We're going to give you cattle for our sacrifice and our avodah in the desert. And the Ramban picks up on that pasuk. Before we get to that Ramban, which is going to introduce the theme, now quickly just keep your finger on the place in Perek Yud. Jump over to Perek Yud Bet and go start the bottom of the top of, let's say the bottom of 356, even though I said 358, but we'll give it a little context. But Yikra LaMoshe Ol Aron Laila. Vayomer kumu tzu'u mitochami, gam atem, gam b'nei Yisrael, ulechu ibdu etanai kidabarchem. Just go and serve your God as you spoke. So this is the completer set. It starts off with the negotiation. Now we see already at the end of Parashat Bo that Paro says, lechu ufu mikan, if we would use the vernacular in Hebrew. Pasuk lamed bet. This is still Paro talking. Gam tzonchem, gam bekachem kachu, kasher dibartem, v'lechu. And when you leave, make sure to bless me. And that's why I think these two psukim are complementary, because the pasuk in Perek Yud exclaims, Moshe said, "Gam titein b'deinu zvachim b'olot," and then at the end, Paro says some sort of form that I need your blessing. So now let's go to the Ramban. Try to keep your finger or these. They have these. What are these blue ribbons? I assume it's blue. Maybe one ribbon and one kind of roll the page over. So take a look at the Ramban. Ramban is the one that started me off on this thinking, and it really has very interesting applications, as we'll see in the Gemara Masechet Shabbat. Gam ata titein biyadeinu zvachim b'olot, lo ama Moshe devar zeh al manat le'asot. Moshe Rabbeinu never intended that they would use zvachim n'olot of Paro. It wouldn't use their animals for avoda. If you'll take it for money and for value and for wealth, absolutely, but not at all for religious practice. V'lo asa kein klal, and he never did it. No, hold on, because then the Netziv is going to return to that. Aval heim divrei chizuk. According to the Ramban, this is rhetorical. It's just part of an argument to emphasize his point and to make it clear that you think you're the strong one in the relationship, you're going to be the weak one and we're the strong. He was leveraging it. Yomar ki tichbad mod yad Hashem alav alimo. God is going to make this very difficult for you. Ad ki gam zvachim v'lot v'cholesh alo yitain bad nafsho. You would do anything to expel us from your country, even giving us zvachim alot. U'bemet v'chi kasher amalehem u'berachtem gam oti. The pasuk later on, and what God said, and you'll bless me. He wanted already forgiveness and atonement. You see that this did come around full circle, exactly as Moshe predicted. Using the pasuk in Mishlei, Moshe never intended to take any sacrificial animal, ritual ownership of something which was used for rishayim, zevach rishayim toeva. And that's how Moshe, that's how the Ramban ends it. Ramban has I'm being recorded, so I'll be a little bit more circumspect. Ramban has a kind of a nationalistic theme in many of his writings. There's a lot of national pride in the way the Ramban looks at biblical exegesis and commentary in general. For a broader conversation, we'll have maybe another opportunity. And now take a look at Rashi. Gam atah titein biyadeinu, lo daicha shemikneinu yelech imanu, ela gam mishalcha titein. So Rashi kind of skips over whether or not they would be used as zvachim v'olot, but if you would move away from the explicit and move towards the implicit, it does seem that Rashi would be disagreeing with Ramban, or Ramban disagreeing with Rashi, better put, that the zvachim v'olot, we'll take it. If you want to give us zvachim v'olot, we're there, and then it fits in with v'berachtem gamoti. I copied for you the Oznayim L'Torah, which is written by Rav Sarutzkin, obviously much later, hundreds of years later, Divrei Moshe on the right underneath it, Divrei Moshe nit kaimu. Ki betzeit yisrael mi mitzrayim, nemar gam tzonchem gam garchem kechuk asher dibartem, u'shtei pamim gam. It says twice, also your sheep and also your cattle, and you'll take it all, because it says, balu rabot olotus vachim. A little bit of a word implication. V'chein kasher dibartem more gam alata titein biyadeinu v'chein mifurash bevorazara shemoshe hekriv olot zvachim mishal paro. And as the Torah comes right out and says it, that this really is a little bit of a dispute in comment, but I think it's a lot more than that. I think there's actually a conceptual dispute here, as we'll see in a few minutes. I think it's more than just was it used or weren't they not used, because the Ramban uses a proof text that you're not allowed to use the animals of Russia, Zevach Rishayim Teva. Take a look at the Netziv, which is right on the left side of it. Uberachtem Gamoti. Or just a little bit of the Netziv and the Ramban are very consistent with one another. Actually, the Netziv is consistent with the Ramban. He follows on. And I find looking at the Netzivs, not that I could in any way claim it'd be expertise in the Netziv, but the studying a little bit of the Netziv, you can find a lot of his also themes of nationalism and the Jewish people as a totality in the Netziv's writing. Of course, he lived during the time where there was a great revolution in thinking, both within the Torah world and in the non-Torah world and in the Haskalah world. So it's not by accident that the Netziv saw the world more of a global perspective. But to take a look at what he says, V'gam brachtem gamoti, haynu shenatan lehem zvachim alot lehit palel alav. Rambam comes right out and disagrees with the Ramban. Kidvar Moshe v'Ramban katav, ki lo asachin Moshe. Moshe did not take it for zvachim alot. Basher Hashem chafetz dakao. He wanted to depress him. He wanted to oppress him. He wanted to punish him. Lo lechaper alav, not to give him atonement. Rak lahanisho. He wanted to have a consequence for his behavior of oppressing the Jewish people and making their life miserable. V'lenaer oto bet kol chelob yam, and ultimately bring them into the water, into the yam, and then shake them until they died and they drowned. Now here's an interesting point. V'lo nireh sheyignov Moshe dato. He's explaining why he disagrees with the Ramban. And without weighing in on this, because I think this entire Parsha Bo includes a fair amount of righteous subterfuge. How's that for a great oxymoron? Legitimate obfuscation is another one. Moshe is being commanded to take a negotiation approach to Paro, which seems to be inauthentic. Shloshah Yamim, we're going to go out for 3 days. Vayishalu, we're going to borrow. At one point it says, then it says Vinat Slum. And this careful reading of Chumash, you could probably argue at a different place. Rabbi Samet, in his very, he produces some very deep, elaborate, sophisticated classes on themes in Parshat Shavuot. He dedicated one of his classes to this, about the morality or the ethical behavior of Moshe in the negotiation. I don't plan on getting into that, but I think the question still needs to be raised, because Neil de Netziv raised it. He said, how could the Ramban say that he would take the Zvachim Nolot and he wouldn't use them for Zvachim Nolot? So the answer is, the Ramban answer, he says, because I'm just using it for a rhetorical negotiation tactic to intimidate my opponent or my enemy. And that's not what the Netziv says. And the Netziv takes a much more, remember, the Netziv writes in the beginning of Bereshit, he's the one who was the one that said that that the reason why Bereshit comes before Shemot is to teach character before you get to any of the mitzvot. And again, and compares it to the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash, where they were tzaddikim that were only tzaddikim bein adam l'makom and not bein adam l'chavero. So, you know, there maybe is a connection here. V'lenei tov, he says, v'lo nireh she'ignov Moshe dato. How would he fool him or trick him or be deceitful? Elavada hit palu alav. He definitely prayed for him. B'shashi higiyu lavodat Hashem. Shahaya b'hagiyam har sinai achar krei yamsuf. Now, we don't see it anywhere in the text that he prayed for them. It's a little like the old joke for those who had the privilege of going to yeshiva somewhere along their life. They had, how do you know Yaakov went out with the yarmulke? I'm sure many of you heard this at some point of your... I mean, there are not that many jokes that can come out of Chumash. It's like, we're very limited as far as sense of humor in biblical exegesis. He says, how do you know Yaakov went out? He says, Vayetze Yaakov miber sheva. Could it be possible that he went out without a yarmulke? Of course he had a cap on, which is a little bit the way Midrash sometimes seems to play out. He seems to take the same approach. He must have davened for them. And how do I know that he must have prayed for Paro? Because Paro was saved. How do I know Paro was saved? Because it's the Medrash says that Paro was saved. So it's a little building a philosophy here on, I think, not a very strong foundation, but this is the interesting ending. V'lavit palu barchu el yamim yotzru. V'im neima. Ram Netziv's sensing, suspecting that his argument may be lacking a little bit of a textual foundation. Im neima shelo asa Moshe kein. Hayam ipnesha Paro shina dvarav. He would have had some engagement of prayer as Vachin Volot had Paro not broken the social contract that he made with Moshe. So once he broke the social contract, then the contract was broken and he never had to pray for him.
Or if he would have not had to wait till the 10th month of
Maybe went too far. Was really, I mean, you're arguing the same thing that it's
Moshe would not have been disingenuous.
Correct. So at that moment, he absolutely intended on taking Zvachim and Alot. If you argue that he didn't use them because the rules changed on him. And he said, you broke the rules, I'll break the rules. Parenthetically, not that I think it requires much attention, because I think it's a lot of noise around an issue that's also lacking significant halachic substance. But just mentioning it because there has some relevance in modern Jewish history, not because I think it needs to be argued, there's a concept of what's called the Shalosh Shavuot in the Masechet Sanhedrin, where the Satmar Rebbe built the entire anti-Zionist crusade, that one of the vows that we took is that lo nimrod b'umo, we won't rebel against the nations. So Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, in his lifetime, he spent a lot of time, I'm not really sure I know why, because it doesn't require that much intellectual energy to try to resolve these issues. But Rav Tzvi Yehuda, and then after his Rav Aviner, discusses the Shalosh Shavuot in several places. One of the answers that Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook gives, that why the Shalosh Shavuot is no longer valid, he said because the Shavuot were taken with several assumptions. That we won't rebel against the nations of the world is on the assumption that the nations of the world won't oppress us. That we will be somewhat fairly treated as subjects in their own land. Once they break the social contract, then the deal is off. And it's there are around 30 answers that Rav Tzvi Yehuda. If anybody's interested, I think I may have a booklet that Rav Aviner wrote about. I'll be happy to loan it to you. And I also have the Satmar Rebbe's book if you want to read that, and then you can have a whole completer set. Maybe another time I'd say more. The difference between the two points of view, between the Ramban and, let's say, the Netziv, or the Ramban and Aznayim HaTorah, the Ramban and Rashi, play out as in the Netziv's secondary question. Well, what was the intention of the Moshe with all of his comments? And I think it's a very legitimate question that Netziv asked. Was he lo yitachein v'chineima, that Moshe was insincere? And the Ramban would say yes. So if you say that, if you extrapolate this is a negotiation, and that all is fair in negotiating with an enemy, Rav Kook does write this in Igrot, that Am Yisrael has to battle its enemy according to the rules of engagement, and the rules of engagement fluctuate. And he writes that if the rules of engagement are such a way that may negate whatever themes that may be prevalent in someone's mind, it has to be contextual to the society in which you live in. So that would make sense. The Ramban, how do you argue? How do you negotiate with an enemy who tried to oppress us for 200 years, and all of a sudden we're going to come out as kind of the moral righteous negotiators and lose the strength of the Jewish people? But if you take the Netziv's question, if he's troubled by it, you can then extrapolate to this question and then apply it to any other area. It's has it vayishalum and has vayinat slum, and how is it chlei chesav chlei zav, and the medrash that they came during choshech and they found where everything was and they took everything out of the cupboards. How do you explain that? So on a simple level, we can explain that then maybe there's a sense of reparations. And we've gone through this in Jewish history not so long ago, that it's okay to take something if it's coming to us, and if they're not giving it to us, we're going to go and grab it. It's interesting that the Medrash is sensitive to it, and that says, V'yishalnah. Moshe said, you please ask them, because he made a haftacha, he made a promise to Avram Avinu, as if people would be reticent, they'd be hesitant, because how can we take from others? There some would say, well, they gave it up willingly, and that V'yinetzlum is that they took advantage, but not in the terms that we know it. That would be an important aspect of this Netziv. How do you look at all of the parashot? And by the way, why do they need the gold and the silver if they're just going to the desert? There are two answers that I saw in Rav Kook, and they actually, to some degree, are not complementary. One answer Rav Kook gives, and if I can find the source, I don't know if I can give it to you if you would ask me to find it, but I just kind of know it in my own mental library, and that always is a little bit risky because I do have a tendency to make things up. So if I made it up, then just bear with me, and I'm attributing it to Rav Kook. I always tell my students that when I turn 50, I just can make things up, and it's okay. I'm okay with that. So I'm just giving you a fair heads up.
That hasn't happened yet.
It hasn't happened. Another 5 years, right? I'm sure I'll get there if I can remember. Right. So one answer is that they needed the gold and silver for the Medrash. The Medrash needed the gold and silver for the Mishkan. That was the easy answer. Rav Kook, of course, writes in a much more nationalistic theme that if they wanted to go ahead and build a country that has a substantial foundation to support a thriving society, you have to have an economy, and the economy needs to be seeded with a fair amount of investment, and that's part of why the Gemara Masechet Megillah, for instance, says if it's the Barech Aleinu Hashem Rechon Zeshana Hazor Bet Kol Menei Tzvuata, first it's Barech Aleinu, and then the next Barech is Teka B'Shofar Gadol Cheiruteinu. So the Gemara Masechet Megillah says that you can't expect Kibbutz Galiot, the incoming of exiles, unless you have an economic foundation to support them. So the gold and silver was part of ultimately building a foundation of an economy to honor, that can layer upon the Jewish people. That's one answer. Yes?
Now, to discuss the Mitzrayim, Paro specifically, the issue of Kenevah's Das, the thesis of the Rambam, that Paro crossed the line, no longer had Pir Chavshis, so he no longer had
him. Oh, that, yeah.
Okay, that kind of opens the gates that Moshe is saying whatever he needed to say that was fulfilling the Ratzon Hashem.
That could be. That would have been interesting if you take that machloket of the taking with Bechir Chavshid and then over into playing it here. That could very well be. I didn't see anybody write that, but that's a very nice answer. Another reason why they took it, according to Rav Kook, this he writes in Ein Iyah, was that in order for them not to start fantasizing about returning to Egypt, If they felt that the streets were lined with gold and they would feel as if that they left so much behind, they took whatever they wanted with them. I think it has another interesting application, for at least from moral education, is that taking the gold and silver ultimately could have been used for the Mishkan or could have been used for Chet Egel. I think the answer there is giving all of us an indication that material wealth could be used to enhance spiritual or at least communal and the foundations of our belief, or it can unfortunately become corrupted and be used for devious means, and it's always our choice. But getting away from the Netziv, who says that, okay, he would have definitely prayed, he was definitely moral, it does touch upon a very interesting... before I get there, I'm sorry, I wanted to get to Shimshon Volhirsch. Now, because I use the old method of copying and pasting, it didn't always fit in. You do it by the way the piece of paper fits into the page, and there's no processing of the computer. Take a look at the bottom of Shimshon Volhirsch. I found this to be fascinating. I better not go too long. Uberachtam gamoti. I almost feel as if I should say it and you interpret it, if you don't mind. Because I have a bias in interpreting according to, if you're a hammer, everything is a nail. And I've been seeing the world through a particular lens lately, and this just fit right in. It just fit in too easily, so I wonder if it's really accurate. So I'm going to pause for a minute after we read it. Gam shetashpiu bezot, if yirachtem oti, you should bless me. When you have this kind of influence, brachal atzmachem, and you start making these blessings for yourselves, kein tashpiu bracha gamalai. Bring this blessing, whatever the concept of the flowing of the blessing onto me, leman taleru kal cholap tzoim, so you can start healing all of these wounds. Behem hu keti ani ve'artzi lemanchem, the wounds that I incurred because of you.
It's not his fault.
No. It's really, he's the victim. Paro could twist this concept of, man, maybe get back to your point that he lost his Bechira Chavshit. And now, I didn't think of that the first time I saw that. And said, your answer would explain this perfectly. That he lost, I am a victim because God took away my freedom of choice. But putting that one aside, because I didn't think of that before I put them on paper, is that I think this is so prevalent today, more than any other time that I could remember, that no matter what somebody is engaged in, how wrong or devious or disappointing or distracting the issue is, it somehow people can turn it right back to the victim. Everybody's a victim today. David Brooks wrote that, a very interesting article a while ago. I put it in my save file, that victimhood today is the only moral card a person can play. So the only way to gain a moral to be legitimately moral is to be the victim. And I won't go too far because it's not really related to Chumash anymore, but it's an interesting point that grows out of this Rav Shimshon Volhirsch, who of course didn't know anything about David Brooks and the victimization of society. Complete peoples are victims today. This touches upon two more points that I want to bring out, and I think I'll make it before Meirav. One is, the first one is brought to my attention by Rabbi Filber. Rabbi Filber was a student of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, and he wrote a book on Parsha Shavuot called Chemdat Yamim. I think that's the name of his book. He incorporates a lot of Kookonian thinking, but in his own scholarly way. He doesn't really, I think, he'll quote Rav Kook extensively, but he's a very original thinker. See, he took this Gemara, the English is here, it's interesting, the English is so much longer than the Hebrew. Maybe I cut off the Hebrew. Let's see what it says. Yatve, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon. You can read it in English. Then I'm certainly out of business if you do. Yatve, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon. Shimon Yechai. They're all sitting together. V'yatav Yehuda ben Gerim, Gabayu. And this Yehuda, the son of converts, was also with this group. He actually had a very good day. He was associated with some of the great Tanayim, of the great rabbis of all time. Patach Rabbi Yehuda v'amar, kama na'im ma'sein shel umazu. Rabbi Yehuda said, how wonderful is the Roman Empire. Tiknu shvakim, they created markets. Tiknu gisharim, and they built bridges, and tiknu merchtzaot, and they've adorned us with hygiene and bathhouses. So Rabbi Yehuda is looking at the Romans, our enemy. You can probably see where this is going, and they were able to enhance our lives. Rabbi Yossi shatak. Rabbi Yossi was in this group, didn't respond. He remained a little bit Doesn't seem either he was indifferent or he was passive or he was non-engaged. We don't really know. Nena Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, of course, took a position. Not surprising. V'amar kol ma shetiknu lo tiknu el litzorach atzman. You think there's value in the fact that they created these enhancements to society? These were all selfish, self-centered, directed, different constructions or initiatives. Shvakin, why do they build markets? Lahoshib behem zonot, so they can have places where prostitutes could solicit. Merchzo, why do they have bathhouses? La'adain behem, so they could just self-indulge. Gisharim, why do they build bridges? Litom and meches, just so they can collect taxes. There was nothing here that was designed to benefit anyone except for themselves. Halach Yehuda ben Gerim, and this is Yehuda ben Gerim. Of course, the story always ends up this way. V'siper Devarim and Ishmael l'Malchut, and the kingdom heard. Amru Yehuda Shi'ilai Yitaleh. Rabbi Yehuda, since he complimented the Romans, he was promoted. His society. Yossi Sheshatak Yiglel Tzipori. That's Rabbi Yossi Haglili. Is Rabbi Yossi Haglili. That's how he ended up there. In case anybody wanted to know. And Shimon Shegina Yehareg. And Shimon bar Yochai, he was a fugitive. All right, let's put the Gemara aside, what happened to the Romans. Anybody can see a connection between the Ramban and the Netziv and this passion? I wouldn't gotten, don't worry. I mean, I had to get here through a filbert. This one I'm not making up. It's complete. I actually checked it and confirmed it before I went to class. Rav Filber said this is, he doesn't say it because I don't think he references the Ramban and the Netziv in the article, but he speaking about how could we incorporate and import the values of external society in cases where the motivation or the impetus behind the initiatives were corrupt or devious. In other words, can we import and take from the broader community, if obviously what we live in a broad community is a fair, just, righteous community, then the question is not relevant. When you live in an oppressive community that it offers benefit and value to the individual, but the root of all the initiative is deceitful and is devious, can it be imported and brought into our culture? And that's the Rav Filber sees machloket. And if you'd ask me, I would think that's the machloket between the Ramban and the Netziv. That the Ramban says that the zevach rishayim toiva, that if a person is involved, if the source of something is going to be illegal and illicit, it can never be transformed into something positive. Almost that can tzedakah money be given from a place that was derived from irreputable ways? Can we look at a person? This is so getting into politics, so we can't go there. But if there's a lot of talk, let's say you can get there on you. You can make your own application. Can we, as an observant, moral, religious community, take from the outside? Now, there is a lot of conversation. The Maral discusses this. Yesh chokhmah b'goyim. I'm not just talking about intellectual property or the pursuit of academia or comparative religions or looking at the way that the non-Jewish world has influenced. These are very well-tread conversations. It would span the spectrum of the different hashkafic beliefs of any religious community. And it's obvious to us there are some communities that would never engage in any general study. Yes?
So just to counter the Zerach Hashanim, there's also the fact that Goyim, Rabbanus from Goyim, are permitted.
Under certain kabbanot, yes.
Whether they're Hashanim or not, maybe that's
the question. That's the question, right. Right. Look, the Russia piece is what needs to be added here. This is not really a conversation about the Jews and the non-Jews. It's a question about whether we can derive benefit from something which is originally the source of it may be devious. There is a Gemara Masechet Sanhedrin speaks about this also, about making a bracha on something stolen. The Gemara says, kol mivarech eino ela minai. It's a person who can make a bracha on something stolen. It's not a bracha. It's a Gemara in that same passage, I think it's the Sanhedrin, Vavaso, Davava Mibet, that same passage, if you drill down, starts talking about Aharon and the Chet Egel. And could the Chet Egel, could it have come out and brought anything good if it, in sense, what the root of it was something, the opposite was true. The root, let's say, if you take Aaron's perspective, if you take it, if you assume as Chag Lad Hashem Machar, that Aaron wanted to redirect the Jewish people to convene them and cohere them and congregate them and hold them together as one until Moshe came down, if you take that narrative, well, that would be interesting if it turns into something of Avodah Zarah, where the source of it was good, but the outcome was negative. So maybe that's why Aaron was looked at a little bit favorably. Yes?
Right.
You mean like the Zevach itself, which was used for Avodah Zarah, was clearly disqualified. Right, or is it Zevach Rishayim,
the Zevach of a Russia? Right. Because if the Zevach is actually used for some Avodah Zarah worship, if the animal was, then it's clearly disqualified. If the person, the Chepta is fine, but
right.
The person is questionable. But that's a fine distinction.
That's a variant. Chepta Gavra, which one are we talking about? How do you interpret the Pasuk?
Right. So otherwise...
Well, how does the Ramban look at it? Since the Ramban introduced it, now that we know from Paro, Zevach Rishayim Toeva, what would be the Chepta of the Gavra using the vernacular of Brisk?
Right. So the issue could not have been that the animals themselves that were given were previously used for anything.
Correct. They'd be dead.
Right.
So it has to be, at least in the Ramban's interpretation, and it goes on the Gavra.
Right.
And that we can't accept a carbon or some ritual acceptance from someone who's on that level. Why would we want to pray for them? It has a lot of, like, very murky implications, because we don't really believe that when it comes to repentance. We know that tshuva is could be partial. We're not looking for people to become tzaddikim. Even if a person is mehara tshuva, shachat, he's already considered forgiven, even though we don't know anything about his or her next steps. Maybe because here we're talking about an oppressor and an enemy of the Jewish people. Do we have a right to forgive? I always listen to, there's a man, Ed Mossberg, I've listened to him speak many times, a Holocaust survivor. For several reasons, I've heard him 5 or 6 times give his presentation. He says we can never forget because if we forget we're killing these people twice. And then he says we can never forgive because it's not our role to forgive. We can't forgive them. And we see also that there is a very strong concept of holding on to our memories of Jews, of our enemies, and maybe they have a different place in the canon of discussion, and it's not really fair to compare it anywhere else. But getting back to this Gemara, clearly Rabbi Yehuda, who complimented the Romans, did see that you can derive benefit from an oppressive regime that could enhance and could benefit ourselves. And can we do business? Could Israel do business with countries that are dictatorships? Can the United States do business with countries that are dictatorships? Can we derive benefit in the short run from people who act in ways that are unethical? I'm not answering the questions. I just think they have interesting applications. Yes. Soon as our brothers, they're self-serving in many ways.
Yeah, still, they were getting good from the
yes,
from evil.
Correct. That's a good point. Right. Philip of the right. And may the Tsar stay far away from us. That's the last prayer I know about the Philip of the Tsar. Yes.
It's interesting because etnan zona is not permissible.
Right.
And he used the word zonot.
Right. Well, because the Romans were doing it.
But the pasuk is you cannot take an etnan zona. You cannot bring korban from.
From
what you're saying, connecting the
that could be. That's a possibility.
The zone of Bedavka.
Maybe that's what he was thinking.
To mind.
Yeah. I don't know. There's always so many layers in what Tanayim and Amoraim write that Rav Levinger, I don't know if you know, he's a very famous, if you know right-wing Gush Emunim history, Rav Levinger was the original founding Rosh Yeshiva of Kiryat Arba Chevron. And I heard him say that when you study Torah, the Nigla is Nister and the Nister is Nigla. No, we think Gemara is Nigla, it's Nister. You think Nister is Nister? It's not. It's actually Nigla. How he took Nister and made it into Nigla, I don't know. But I certainly understood how Nigla is Nister. Take a look at the last source that I want to bring to your attention. And this goes kind of a modern day leap. And before we close it back down, back to the Chumash. This is Rav Shagar. Some are familiar with this shul. There is I think Rav Gottlieb seems to be a real expert. A lot about Rav Shagar. I see he's a very complex writer and philosopher, and I certainly give Rabbi Gottlieb credit for mastering one of the more sophisticated thinkers of our generation. Unfortunately, Rav Shagar passed away. Vizot HaShela HaKashesh LeFaneinu. Im lahat shel emuna v'shorshiyut yehudit lefaneinu, kesher shalama kodesh latzorach dusha, is the kafi shesover echad migdolei haTorah b'dorenu, yesh kan tarovet shelumiyut chilonit v'shel choser shorshiyut. Is the enthusiasm for Zionism today, is it about the Jewish people's inherent connection to the land and its holiness, or is the advent and the manifestation of Zionism kind of a mix of multiple different philosophies that is just reflects a nationalistic movement of secularism and has no roots within Judaism? So is the framing it differently, taking from a movement which has no religious value, and I'm adding now, okay, because I got another 5 years, I'll be 50, so I can get a head start on this. I don't know if this is what he meant. And you, taking also benefit from parts of Israel society which are counter to assumptions of Torah and mitzvot. In other words, taking that example to some degree and kind of drawing a faded line between the discussion of Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Yochanan and Ben Zakkai, and connecting that very faded dotted line to modern Israel society, where there are those who would see part of the development of Israel not within the context of Torah and mitzvot, and maybe to some degree anti-Torah and mitzvot, where there's certainly voices like that, certainly in the early 1900s, a little less so, more muted today, but nevertheless under the surface. Hashelazo, by the way, if you'd ask Rav Cook this question, I can tell you what his answer would be. His answer, that sounds very arrogant. I can guess and think what his answer would be. His answer would be is that any manifestation of Jewish expression from Jews, whatever the source is Jewish. And if the Zionists were completely secular, but they had pining and an inner connection to the land of Israel for the sake of settling the land and creating Jewish sovereignty, he said that in of itself was a mitzvah, and he had no question, unequivocal. And that's really throughout his writing. But now Rav Shagar is taking a different approach to this. He says, "Hashela hazot amuka ma'od, mahi ota l'umiyut chilunit." What is exactly a nationalism, secular nationalism? Hemieshla shorshim b'kedusha? Is it possible that there's some depth to it that has its roots in holiness? O shema chalila he einash shayechet l'shorsha v'gizah kedishai d'Israel, and it doesn't really have any connection to the root of Am Yisrael. V'hadvar mamukim v'nogim ad hashitin shel kiyumenu, and this is coming to the actual essence of our existence. B'sofo shel davar gam zeh talui banu. And this is an interesting answer, which I want to apply back to what we just learned. Gam zeh talui banu b'maaseinu hatovim. B'tshuva amitit shelanu, it's all about our actions and our good deeds. B'yicholteinu la'alot et hakol l'kedusha, if we can import from a source which is dubious and transform it into a focus of holiness, u'la'ir b'chol davar et ora Torah mitit, and then inject it with a sense of authentic Torah, la'ir b'chol davar et Yisrael et Torah Yisrael. He says, it doesn't really matter, because it doesn't really matter what their source is, it matters how we apply it. And if the application could include an injection or infusion or an association with the basic philosophy of Torah, we can have that power to transform it. Now, whether or not he would connect that backwards to the Romans is very objectionable. I don't think it's clear at all, because one thing is about Am Yisrael, getting back to the Kukonian thinking, that if it's a manifestation of Jewish thought, then in and of itself it's inherently Jewish. Maybe it's a little bit corrupted, but it doesn't take away from the value of it, so it may not leap backwards. And then leaping it all the way backwards, you know, it's if we really want to scroll the clock back, can you then take this and then apply it back to the Ramban and then it's Siv? That according to the Ramban, would you say that you can transform something which is inherently disqualified because of its value, like the Ramban would say, or you would take the Netziv, almost, Rav Shagar, and say that it really depends on how we apply what we import. And that would be the machloket, let's say, between Rabbi Yehuda, who said we can't benefit from the bridges and from the markets and the Mechtzot. And why Rabbi Yossi Shatak, we're not really sure. Or is it Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai, who would certainly parallel himself backwards? Now let's go one step earlier. Does this impact at all on our thinking whether or not it was legitimate for the Jewish people to take Klei Chesed or Klei Zahav? Can we then take it to the next level? So I'm going to leave that one a little open. And just to remind everybody that this conversation was very intense in the 1950s, between Menachem Begin and the labor government at the time, Ben-Gurion, whether or not the Jewish people, Israeli rights, should be permitted to take reparations. And Menachem Begin took a very strong, unequivocal, uncompromising view. Full of, you can get a hold of some of those tapes on YouTube and see it. And you can probably get it at the Begin Museum. I think you can still see it. You can see some of his positions on that.
And he came around also, eventually.
Did he come in philosophically or just pragmatically?
I believe that was pragmatic. You've got to look at people who are starving.
Right.
We have ideals.
Right. In the 50s, he didn't want to legitimize them. I mean, look, the period of time in the 50s was different when he became prime minister in the 80s. I mean, that's a long time for... Usually when people change their mind, they usually don't declare publicly, oh, what I said in 1952, I don't believe anymore.
He mellowed,
right. But whether or not he changed his mind because he philosophically believed it or was pragmatically, I don't know, but he did change. Anyway, thanks for this opportunity. I hope we didn't get too far into any political thinking. There was certainly a lot to be said here that wasn't said, but I'd leave that to all of your high IQs to make your own connections.
Thank you very, very much. Rabbi Hartstock is next week.